this is Sabrina George for New Comedy Radio interviewing Jill Edwards, who is now living by the coast near Brighton, sitting in her flat having a chat. So, Jill, I've obviously known you since I started because you taught me. It's my normal opening question. What got you, because you started off actually being in the comedy world yourself, what was your first action to actually become a comic?
How
rather
happened,
than thinking about it, was what I mean.
Yeah, I kind of fell into it because I was doing a play in Edinburgh when I was a student. We're talking many, many years ago. I was a student and I'd just been chucked out of Polytechnic for not really attending any of the lectures and decided I wanted to do something else. So I took a play up to the Edinburgh Fringe.
What were you studying at Polytechnic?
Communication Studies.
Okay.
Very early degree version of it, and I'm not academic. I spent a lot of time, I seem to recall, playing bingo with a man called Nigel, as opposed to going to lectures. So quite understandably, they threw me out, and they're absolutely right too. I was an appalling student. So I took a play up to the Edinburgh Fringe Festival, and it was Carol Churchill's Cloud Nine.
Oh yeah?
Yeah. So there was a big group of us, and it was like me and some of the people from Coventry where I was living at the time, and some people from Leicester University. One of the people from Leicester University who was a mate's girlfriend was Rachel, who subsequently became my double act partner. And what we decided was that to publicise the play, I wanted to form some kind of street theatre cabaret act thing, basically to publicise this play. And the play did very well. But in actual fact, what we found was that we got bookings as a comedy act. And I decided that I didn't really fancy going into acting, because it just wasn't me. And I'd sort of discovered the circuit, the comedy circuit. I discovered comedy clubs in London. It was very new, I mean, this is a long time ago. And I'd seen a few performers and been to a few comedy clubs and just thought, oh, this is brilliant. This is just fantastic. I want to be part of this. And we started getting bookings as a double act. So when we got back to Coventry, where we were living at the time, TikTok Theatre Company had just opened a comedy club and they needed local acts to be the support acts. So we were one of the four local comedy acts that was the support acts all the time for all the acts coming out from London. So we met and kind of worked with everybody who was in those days the big headliners. Like, there was, at that time it was thinking about who we met, like Paul Merton, Mark Thomas, Phil Cornwell, I don't think Joe Brown was around at that time, but so we kind of met all those people and they kind of said, oh, you really ought to go down to London and try out. So very naively, the first place we went to was Jongleurs. And we asked if we could do a tryout at Jongleurs. And it went really well. We had to do an audition. And then they put us on to do 5 minutes and it went really well. So we did 2 more 7-minute slots at Jongleurs and got booked at Jongleurs. So we sort of appeared on the circuit from nowhere, seemingly, but we'd actually been going for 2 years in Coventry beforehand. And we were then booked everywhere else, basically on the strength of that, really.
The Jongleurs is one of the big comedy chains. It's sort of like the commercial end of comedy.
Yes, but in those days, it was just one night in one club.
Yeah.
In Clapham, Battersea, really. Yeah, it was quite small then.
And what was your double act?
We were called Pep Talk.
And did you talk, or did you sing, or did you dance?
Oh, yes,
or?
It was a singing double act, primarily. We did funny songs. So it's me and my double act partner, Rachel. We wrote funny songs. We started off doing the same old thing of changing words to music you already had. So, you know, like every female double act, we seemed to have done a version of Favourite Things. And then we started moving on to, you know, we did use people like Tom Lear or various other people, Victoria Wood, of course. And then we started actually writing our own stuff. And then we got a big DX7, which is like a big keyboard that can sound like a piano. We started using that. So we just developed the app to the point we were writing our own songs. But yeah, it was me chatting in between and the two of us singing funny songs. But there's only ever been female double acts that sing have only ever appeared at once on the circuit. Like there was us. We were the only female singing double act. And then after us, when we finished, there was two girls what sing. And it seems like female double acts that sing are very kind of rare on the circuit.
Yeah, Chambers and Nettleton are the only ones around at the moment that I know of.
Yeah, it's weird, isn't it? It's like there's only room for one at a time.
Yeah. I think, it's quite demanding. And what happened to bring that to an end?
A number of things, really. I started getting offers to do other things that I thought were very interesting and I wanted to do. So I worked with the London Bubble Theatre Company for a while. We did the most extraordinarily camp musical pantomime in which I got to sing and dance and stuff, and I really enjoyed that, and I got offered a lot of adverts, and I wanted to write as well, so I was being offered a lot of different things I wanted to do, and my double act partner Rachel was basically getting a bit fed up with everything and not really sure she wanted to carry on, and we sort of got to that point where she really just wanted to strike out and do something else. She just had enough basically of being a comedy performer, and I was spending less time on the act than on other things, so we decided best to just stop while we were ahead, while we could leave with having done great gigs. So we did a sort of massive storming gig at the Banana as our last gig and got two encores and felt, okay, great, that's the best way to leave. And we went down to the store and had a drink with everyone and said, okay, that's it for pep talk, and then both went off and did different things.
Oh.
So it was all very amicable, but it was time, you know, we kind of both done what we wanted to do.
Well, so I was going to say, what was it like then, touring around as a double act?
Oh, fantastic. I really enjoyed every minute of my time as being part of double act. Kind of, when it ended, it was like time to end, but when we were doing it, it was fab. It was particularly good if we were doing sort of the Swansea Festival. So you're like stuck in Swansea for a week, and it's so nice to have your best
Swansea's
mate with
you. Swansea's the big city in Wales.
Yes, that big city in Wales. And they had this wonderful thing where they decided one year that they were going to do these sort of gigs in tiny little villages in Wales, kind of all the way, all around Swansea. And they just decided to try this one particular year. And it meant basically doing gigs in minute pubs in obscure little villages where only four people turned up. It was some kind of outreach project, and we did do one gig where we were performing and the four people in the audience were passing a joint round. And they did actually pass it across the stage as well, and it was just a little bit like being in someone's living room. So Swansea was always brilliant. Edinburgh Fringe Festival, great to have your best mate with you. Living on a diet of Edam cheese for some reason. I don't know why, but that's all that Rachel and I ever ate in Edinburgh. And also doing kind of anything out of town, it was particularly good that there was always two of us. And we always got on enormously well and had an absolute hoot. I really, really liked being a double act. I couldn't really imagine. I mean, lots of people asked me if I would go solo once Rachel really decided she didn't want to do it anymore. I thought about it and thought, well, it would be an easy thing to do, but I just didn't fancy it. Just didn't fancy the idea of doing it on my own. I so enjoyed the whole kind of me and Rachel trooping around the country and having a laugh and doing the gigs and all the things that happened.
That's all right.
I just didn't fancy doing it on my own, basically.
So what was the next move into comedy after that, then?
Well, after that, I did sort of a few different bits and pieces, and then I thought, well, I don't really know where I'm going. And I decided that I really did want to get into writing, really seriously wanted to write.
What sort of writing? Books, movies, other people's sets?
No, I wanted specifically to write film and TV scripts. I actually initially started writing radio, and because I spent so long being comedy orientated and just writing funny stuff, the first radio play I wrote was an apocalyptic, kind of gloomy, just appalling, actually, just an appalling, appalling script. And I just, I kind of started off just by writing radio scripts to learn how to write radio scripts. And then they got a little bit more focused. And I got an agent, a tremendous agent. And basically, I was incredibly passionate about writing. And in order to support my writing career at the time, I decided to start a stand-up comedy course.
Right.
That's where it originally came from, and I just thought, okay. And obviously, in those days, there wasn't... The whole notion of teaching stand-up comedy was completely new, and most people just said, oh, you can't teach comedy. And nobody really believed that you could do it. There was only one other workshop at the time, and that was the one that ran at Jackson's Lane, a little community centre in North London. And that was sort of kind of sporadically run by a group of comics turning up every week and talking to people who wanted to be comics. And, you know, some good people had come out of those workshops. But that was all there was at the time. And what I wanted to do was to create a course that covered everything, that a proper structured course that covered everything that new acts needed to know in order to become established comics. Because I'd been an established comic, and what I wanted was to use that knowledge. Also, I'd done a lot of booking, sort of run festivals and stuff like that, and I wanted to also pass that knowledge on So I basically sat down and created a list of everything that I thought new acts needed to know, from A to B, right from the very beginning to how to write materials, you know, a number of writing methods, right through to, and then how do they get work. And I also interviewed hundreds of comics and bookers, and I got all of their feedback and input as well. And then I created this course out of that, and it took a while to develop it, but it got into the City Lit, which is where I suppose it really took off.
Which is in London.
Yes, the City Literary Institute.
A college in London, yeah.
So yes, it's an adult education centre, but it's kind of the main one, the main adult education centre, and I really like their philosophy. The City Literary Institute was originally designed so that poor people who had to work during the day could get training, could do degrees and get qualifications and training in evening classes that would mean that they could improve their lot and go on to get better jobs and make more money and whatever they wanted to do. And I just really liked their philosophy. It's very heavily subsidised and funded so that the courses are accessible to everyone. So once I got into there, that felt like a point where the teaching really felt very solid, and also I was subject to Ofsted inspections, which is sort of a school inspection board to make sure you're teaching properly, doing good teaching practice, you've got proper lesson plans and stuff. So I kind of learned then to teach the course and to teach and to structure the course in a really good, strong teaching way, with good teaching practice and decent structure and stuff, which has really stood me in good stead.
Mm.
It's really been valuable to actually learn how to do it properly. So the comedy course is actually a proper course, with handouts and structure and showing developmental progress and stuff like that.
So when you, because I've been on the course myself, so you're going to have to treat me as asking questions out of naivety, even though that's not the case. When you, because as I understood it, you don't stream the people who come onto the course. Anybody can go onto the course.
Absolutely.
If they sign up and they turn up, they are on the course.
Absolutely.
Once the course is in place, what, in your experience, are the three factors that, let's say three because there's many, that you look out for to go, oh, that person looks like they could be interesting?
I actually never make any judgments at all.
You don't at all?
No. Because one of the amazing things about teaching the course is people are endlessly surprising.
Mm.
And it's just wonderful. There is that incredibly thrilling moment when somebody gets up and they do something that just blows you away, and you just think, wow, no idea whether they're going to be able to do it again, or whether they'll be able to sustain that, or whether they'll end up being able to have the personality to get a career in comedy. I mean, everybody can come on my course. It's open to everybody. I don't care why people come on the course. They come on it to, people come from all walks of life, all ages, all classes. Either they're just interested in comedy, or they want to make some new friends, or they lack confidence and want to get a bit more confident. And also, there's always people on the course, a good chunk of people on the course, who really want to be stand-up comics. And what I found is that for some reason that mixture works incredibly well. I don't know why, but it has always worked fantastically. But as to whether they could have a career in stand-up comedy, that is an entirely different issue.
Mm.
They can certainly write their own set of material and perform it by doing the course. Whether they'll then actually go on to be a professional comic, I can't guarantee that, and I don't know.
Mm.
That will be up to them if they've got the drive and the sheer bloody mindedness.
Mm.
And they may well do it, they may not. So I can't teach somebody to become a professional career and get a job as a, you know, and to be a professional career comic and actually definitely succeed. So I can't say to everyone, okay, you will definitely make it. All I can say is, I can show you how to write and perform material.
Mm.
I can guide you all the way through to that. Whether you actually end up being able to do it as a living, I can't tell you that.
Because one of my tiny bits of experience looking back over the comics is some people who turn up have what I would call naturally funny bones. They get up there and they're really funny. And about 80% of the time, they're the sort of people who don't turn up on time, who don't understand that there's a schedule to run to, that, you know, book to go on holiday when there's the big show to go on the day they come back. They can't. It's a really bizarre thing, but that combination of funny bones and discipline seems to often fight against itself.
Very interesting that, and it's a very. I've encountered some people that were just so good, But, like you say, couldn't actually hack the whole gigging for various reasons, because they couldn't, they weren't organised enough, or they just, or sometimes, oddly enough, too nervous. They'll be absolutely fantastic, but they just get too nervous and don't want to perform. And then you've got the other people, bless them, who are, God, they're going to work hard, they're going to work their asses off to be the best comic ever. And somehow then, you know, you kind of know they're probably never going to be the greatest comic in the world. But they'll be a jobbing comic. They'll get work, and they'll have a career in the comedy business. So,
because it's something I remember you saying ages ago. I think it was at the beginning of the course. I can't remember anyway. You said it, and you said, "I'll teach you how to do stand-up comedy, but you might not become a stand-up comic. You might write in it. You might produce it. You might,
that's true.
Do all these other areas." And I think, from my experience of the way you structure the course, you can come out with quite a good 360-degree perspective on comedy.
Yeah,
which doesn't necessarily mean that you will become the stand-up comic on stage, but you might become something else connected with it, or maybe even be a tremendous writer of tragic novels, but know how to structure a joke within it.
That's very deliberate as well with the course, that that while I focus on teaching them to become stand-up comics, I do say very clearly, you could end up doing some completely different thing in comedy, because it is a very deliberate act on my part to really get them to understand about the comedy circuit, the history of the comedy circuit, what comedy is in this country, you know, to really give them a perspective. So people have ended up, I mean, obviously, for instance, Hannah Chambers, Jimmy Carr's
one of the
agent,
most successful agents.
Yeah, she's one of the most successful agents around, and she did my course.
Yeah.
And that's what she got out of it, was she ended up becoming a really successful agent, and incredibly proud of her.
Yeah.
And now also represents ex-students like Jimmy, which is terrific. Jenny Colgan. Another example of someone who wrote great stuff but really didn't enjoy gigging very much, sat down one day and wrote a book and sold it for $1 billion. And is now a top writer and making a lot of money writing books. So it's, and there are quite a few students I run into who are doing, the students running really high profile clubs, or there'll be writers on people's shows and stuff as well. So they don't, I mean, oddly enough, people like, I'm sure, my course has nothing to do with this, but Tracy Ann Oberman, who played Desi's wife on EastEnders, is an ex-student. I was watching her thinking, how bizarre, well, that's nothing to do with me, but it's still interesting. I talked to her a while back and she said, well, you know, just I kind of got about how to perform comedy, and she did a great production of Loot in the West End, and she did feel that kind of there had been a connection, it had helped, it had pushed her along the path. So, yeah, they don't all become comics, but they, a lot of them do actually do something within the comedy realm. And it might be writing, it might be presenting is another one. I've just got a new student who's just on the course 6 months ago, who's just been offered a fantastic presenting job. And that's, I think that's right for him. Mm. I think that's really where his skill lies.
Mm.
So yeah, it's interesting how the course actually seems to spawn a lot of people doing a lot of other things as well.
Mm. What do you think are the key things you need to teach on your course, rather than specific individuals? What are the key points you really want to get across to people?
That's an interesting thought, because the immediate thought that comes into my mind is, well, writing methods are tremendously important. To offer them enough writing methods and ways of creating material so that they'll find something that works for them, or be able to devise something that works for them. That's a major one. So I'm constantly actually devising or finding new writing methods so that everybody can find a way to create material and to have the confidence to create their own writing method. But hand in hand with that, which is another incredibly important thing, is how to actually structure their comedy, how to understand setup, punch, gags, to understand what those look like, what those are, what is a punch, to really understand how that works, to understand formats like list of three, compare and contrast, you know, using visual, you know, really understanding all the things that you can use to create a great gag, and also structuring your set, so topics. It's so much easier for new acts to start by understanding how to write topics. So, you know, you say what it is you're going to talk about it in the first gag, and you state what your attitude is going to be or what your point's going to be. The next couple of gags illustrate or set up, you know, illustrate what you've said or back up your point. And it's a much easier way to construct a topic. I've explained that very well, but it's just a much easier way for for newer comics to create material. And its structure is just tremendously important. Agents mention it a lot. I do sometimes get agents sending me clients that are doing very well, but their structure's a bit weak.
Mm.
And that's interesting because it's so far down the line. And when you start teaching someone structure who's been going for 10 years, just kind of think, blimey, if you'd known this, you know, if you started off knowing this, this would be a lot easier to teach you. Also, writing methods is another thing.
Mm.
The agents send me people to work with me because they're struggling with writing, creating new ideas, and again, teaching them new writing methods, which is easier actually with people who've been going longer to teach them new writing methods. Structure is the seems to, for some reason, be the stumbling block for most people, and it's so important.
Yeah,
it's so incredibly important because.
Well, I see a lot of acts coming off from other courses, let's put it like that, and they might have 7 minutes of possibly, you know, their first and only 7 minutes that the audience is going to see. And you sit there and you go, well, there's actually 3 minutes of there, which is great stuff.
Yeah.
But they've stuck with the one topic.
Oh, no.
You know, the relationship they have there with their lawnmower.
Yeah.
Now, that's all right for maybe 3% of the audience might be fascinated by lawnmowers and go, 7 minutes, and all fantastic.
Yeah.
But the rest of the audience is going, we never liked lawnmowers, we don't know what they are,
we don't care.
No,
you can't do one topic for 7 minutes, that's ridiculous.
No.
I don't think so, unless you're an amazingly established comic, and he's fantastic, and you can make lawnmowers interesting for 7 minutes. Essentially, I teach people a topic should be between 5 to 7 gags.
Mm.
Yeah, and you make sure you open it by making it clear what the topic is and what your attitude is towards it, illustrating your point, back up your statement in the next couple of gags, escalating to the final gag, which should be the funniest and which should close the topic down. And that means that if the audience aren't interested in a topic on lawnmowers, they only have to listen to 5 to 7 gags on lawnmowers. That's it.
And then move
There's
on.
Another topic coming
yeah.
up.
Yeah. Yeah.
And also the other thing I do notice is a good point, is saying, editing, my God, nobody seems to learn to edit anymore. There's no point of having anything in your set if it's not part of a setup or a punchline.
Mm.
But there is no point in anything else because you're a comic, and if you don't have punchlines in your set, you don't have a comedy set. You know, people have come to a comedy club to laugh.
Mm.
They want to be made to laugh. The more original you are, the better. But there's no point in arguing about setup and saying, oh, it sounds it's too restricting. The greatest people comics use it so that it looks like conversational, like it's coming off the top of their head. And that is written down, structured material. The art of a stand-up comic, a great stand-up comic, is that they make their material look as if it's just come off the top of their head.
Mm.
But that takes a lot of structure
mm.
and a lot of skill. I love watching someone like Eddie Izzard. Sometimes I say, wow. You show an Eddie Izzard video to students, they're like, oh no, there's no setup punch in there, no. And I'm just like, well, are you laughing? Yeah. What are you laughing at? The punchlines. Uh-huh. What is the bit before? Setup. Okay, so I reckon there probably is setup punch in there. It's very hard for people to actually accept the notion that somebody who sounds conversational is using a format. People are very resistant to it. It's interesting.
Well, it's also interesting, but particularly with someone like Eddie Izzard, is that if you took out one word, it wouldn't make any sense.
No.
Every word he puts in means something.
Which it should be with all comics. That's,
it sounds like it's a bit of blather going around around the circle, but actually, everything he says is relevant. I was at the Gong Show at the Comedy Store on Monday, which is a notorious show on the whole monthly on a Monday night, and new acts go on, and if they survive 5 minutes, then they have a sort of knockout section, and the one person wins becomes King Gong for the month. And it's the most sadistic thing you've ever seen. It's absolutely criminal. And the amount of new comics that got up and spent at least 30 seconds saying, hello, how are you doing?
Yeah.
Are there any Americans in the audience?
Yeah.
Completely.
No.
And they didn't get to their gag till a minute. And then if the first gag after a minute didn't work, they were off. And maybe they had 4 minutes, 3.5 minutes of diamond stuff, but the audience never got to hear it.
That's another thing that I even find myself teaching people who are quite established. Get to the first gag straight away. Straight in with a laugh, because the minute you make the audience laugh, they go, oh, thank goodness, they're going to be funny. But the new act, all the audience want to know is, please, we're going to say, don't embarrass us, please be funny. Yeah, come on, you might say, hi, I'm so-and-so. Boom, straight into your first gag. And I recommend to new acts, basically, that they use three standalone gags at the beginning of a set, that they will be the hardest ones to write, they'll be taking the longest to find. But gags that set up what the act's going to be like, and also get across an idea of their personality, what kind of an act this is that's coming up. So those three gags are very important. You know, if you're not a topical comic, don't come on and do a topical gag, because that's not what your act's going to be about. Those three standalone gags should introduce you to the audience. They're a sort of a hello. some things about me, so that the audience makes some kind of a connection with you and laughs and relaxes.
So to me, that's also something that is very artificial, but it's an artificiality that one's got to get over, because when you meet someone for the first time, you do not say, you know what, my hair's brown.
Yeah.
You don't say, I know I'm tall, but, you know, you don't go in straight off with something
but
like that.
And
generally, people are thinking it, exactly.
That's what you're doing, is you're connecting to what the audience are thinking. If someone comes on, you know, for instance, I've watched Joe Brand walk on stage a million times in the old days, and that, you know, the audience thinking, oh, she's big. Oh, she's big. And it's attention. And the minute she says yes, she can just say yes, I'm big, and they will fall about laughing, because what she's done is she's connected to what they're thinking.
They've done the setup and she's doing the punch.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that's the point, is that the more physical, you know, it's a huge advantage to be big or to have ears that really stick out or to be very tall and thin, because the audience are doing the setup as you walk on.
Or not to be from the background of your audience.
Yeah, anything.
Yeah.
Anything that provides a setup. And so, yes, it is different in a way from starting a normal conversation, but it's creating your link with your audience. It's a connecting comment.
Mm.
I mean, a lot of comics, another thing I've been teaching students lately is connecting comments. When you go on stage, you say something that the audience can see, hear or feel, that you can all see or hear or feel. So it might be a comment about the venue, might be a comment about it being really hot, might be a comment about, I remember in the old days we used to pick up cabs on one of the speakers at one of the clubs. I can't remember for life which club it was now, but the local cab firm used to quite often come through on the speakers.
Mm.
And it would be a bit like being heckled by the cab firm. And comics, you know, we often commented on that. That's a little link, a bond between you and the audience. We're all in it together.
Mm.
We're all too hot.
Mm.
Or it's a bit smoky for all of us.
Mm.
And that's a connecting comment. Again, it's about how do you create a connection with this audience as soon as you go on.
Mm. I remember going on the day the Sunday papers broke the story of John Major, ex-Prime Minister at that point, and one of the senior ministers, Edwina Curry, having this bizarre relationship. And all I did was walk on stage and said, sometimes you can't make it up, John Major, Edwina Curry.
Marvellous.
Massive laugh.
Yeah, great.
And there was no joke in there, but it was something that was being shared, and it's exactly that example.
Yeah.
You just think, well, I don't have to write it because
it's just
the
a
joke
comment,
is exactly, exactly.
Sometimes people try terribly hard, and then you kind of agonise over doing it, yet another gag about Michael Jackson. And really, all they need to do is just, a little simple comment. I think stand up comedy is actually much more, it's certainly a hard skill, it's certainly something you've got to work hard at. But in a way, the job is to simplify what you're doing. Take it backwards. You don't have to agonise over that opening gag. It may just be something terribly simple like you've just said.
Yeah.
That's perfect.
Yeah. And then the audience is on your side, and then
you
can... And the other thing which you've mentioned already is this wonderful thing called attitude.
Mm.
Some people call persona.
I know, the two
you
are
call
different.
Attitude. Yeah.
No, the two are different.
Describe.
Oh, okay. Persona is the comic's personality on stage. Now, with most stand-up comics, it will be just a slightly exaggerated version of what they're like off stage. With a lot of them, they are exactly the same off stage as they are on stage. But what tends to happen when you go on stage is that certain characteristics can tend to get a bit elevated. So if you're a slightly neurotic person off stage, you might find that your comedy becomes very neurotic, and that when you're on stage, you're in fact quite a neurotic comic. Same with comics who are very laid back off stage. When they get on stage, they might be more laid back. So that would just be their persona, it's just their personality.
Expanded or exploded.
Yeah, kind of extended areas of it get extended. And it might be that you take certain areas of it back. So you're kind of working with your own personality, but just letting bits of it extend and bits of it come back again. And I think that's best found through certain writing methods. I don't think that's something you decide. I think you develop that. In my course, my foundation course, the kind of course that I'm running, Comedia at the moment, that happens over a few weeks in that first course. By the end of it, most people know what their persona is. They discover their inner voice, their kind of their inner comic. That is inner comic work. They discover their comic voice, and they haven't had to think about it. Essentially, I don't think you should think about it. I think you write, and it becomes apparent. That's how you find it. Now, attitude is different. That's going to vary from topic to topic. So that's how you feel about the thing you're talking about, and that's terribly important. You need to know how you feel about what you're talking about. So take your example of lawnmowers. If you're going to go on and you want to do a topic about lawnmowers is a great big topic. you need to decide either what your point is or how you feel about them. So if it's, I love lawnmowers, then all of your gags are going to be backing up the why you love them, what's so wonderful about them, and that creates a lovely coherent topic. If you hate them, then it's you're going to be like, oh, lawnmowers, and it's going to be a different attitude towards it. You hate them, so all the gag's going to be about hating lawnmowers and why you hate them. So it's going to vary from topic to topic. And regardless of what your persona is, you probably will find that some attitudes are stronger than others, that you do more hates or you do more worries, tends to be the way it goes. But you do, attitude is so important. If you don't have an attitude towards what you're talking about, the audience won't laugh. Because they're laughing as much at the attitude as they are towards the material. And the more unexpected an attitude you have towards something...
I love war.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The better.
Yeah.
And if you're doing I love war, you'd have to do it sarcastically because an audience is going to balk at that.
Well, I don't know. I was just talking to someone who's just... I've just done this with before, and there were aspects of war that they really liked. It wasn't the war itself. It was the... And I think that there are some really controversial subjects that you can... I mean, there was that famous movie the Italian guy made about being in the concentration camp with his son. And
yes.
it was all about pretending it was a game.
Mm.
And I would say, you know, if that was a movie, but I thought that was a fascinating attitude. If you take from that perspective, if we're going
well,
to keep us all...
that's an angle, though, isn't it? That's an angle. He's chosen an angle. And that is a very interesting angle. Something like war... you've got to pick an angle. I suppose if I think about the person who could most talk about that, in my view, would be someone like Mark Thomas, who will pick an angle, and it will be the kind of...
He's a political comic, yeah.
Yeah, he's a great political comic, and he will talk about that kind of subject in a way that's very accessible and makes a point.
Mm.
And that's going to be... It's going to be funny as well as interesting, which is his great skill. He's going to be funny as well as interesting and informative politically, so... I think the important thing is with any subject, whatever you're tackling, I think it's better if it's true, if it's something very strong. If you're doing something controversial, you have to have a point.
Yeah.
Because new acts bounce on stage and start doing controversial subjects. They've got... Because they're trying to shock the audience. Like, the only way that a new act can shock an audience is by being good. That is the bottom line. Bouncing on stage and suddenly going, right, abortion, that just shocks them. They're just rigid with shock and hoping that you're going to get off quickly.
And dislike, yes.
Yeah, you go on stage and you do a good, well-honed, funny act. They are so relieved they will practically marry you by the end. That is how you shock an audience, by being good, and that is always going to be the way.
So there's a number of attitudes that things fall into. There's worry, bewildered, love, hate.
Well, I basically use worry, hate, fear. Worry, hate and fear is the basic ones. And then add in things like love and I'm proud of afterwards. So this is all Judy Carter's lists method, which I think is very good. It's a good starting point. You make a list of all the things you hate, all the things that worry you and all the things you're frightened of. And you look at the really oddball little quirky things. And it's a way of actually getting students to look at the world they live in. We all live in the same world, and that's very important for a comedy audience to feel that the comic is saying, yeah, we all live in the same world. But look, here's my view. And the fascinating thing about doing that exercise is that people who think that they're not particularly unique or not particularly interesting will discover that they have many, many strange little things that they worry about or that they hate that other people really just aren't bothered about. And that when they start talking about them, that becomes very funny.
Mm.
And a fantastic student who's doing very well at the moment. She just got through to the Heats of So You Think You're Funny in Edinburgh. And one of the first things she ever said to me in the most extraordinary voice was, well, problem is, I'm boring. The whole class just fell about, and her whole act is this, yeah, this is about as excited as I get. And that is just how she is. And it is lovely, and her world is kind of informed by this. It's very domestic, but it's informed by this slightly quirky view. And it's actually the way we see the world that is so exciting, and you just don't realise how unique people are until you do that exercise with them.
Yeah.
And then they begin to realise how unique they are.
Yeah.
And it's really, really nice. So it's very important for comics to, if you're an aspiring comic, to really understand how you see the world that we all live in and what your attitude towards the things you're seeing is, because that's what will drive your material. That will be the fuel that will enable you to talk about that particular subject.
Because it's an area that I find kind of difficult to explain to comics coming from overseas, is they will often try and either keep exactly the same set or transfer that set to a London audience. And actually, what I want to see with a Japanese comic, a Nigerian comic, Canadian comic, whatever, is their world.
Yeah.
Because I don't know anything about it. Mm. You know, or I have a limited Absolutely. Nodding acquaintance. And if they can say, well, you know, we do this weird stuff here.
Yeah, fantastic.
I just absolutely love it. It's one of the great things I did when I was doing the Shetland Folk Festival. I don't know anything about folk and I don't know anything about the Shetlands. And I just got chatting to this guy in the audience and found out he was a fisherman.
Oh,
and started a conversation about what was his favourite type of fish. Well, you'd have thought, but his world revolves around haddock.
Yeah, of course, because he's
Who would
a
have thought?
But that's the same with writing, just
yes.
keep writing.
Yes.
If you have a character that's a fisherman, inevitably his world is going to be slanted by the fact that he's upset eating fish.
Mm.
It's a lovely thing for. That's what. That is another thing that's interesting about doing a stand up course. The way that I start the course is so that actually you can take that same basic and apply it to writing scripts. If you have a character that's a fisherman, he will talk about fish, because that's his world. His world view will be around...
Fish-orientated, yeah.
Fish-orientated. The weather is going to be a massive part of his life.
In a different way to it is someone
yeah,
who...
Yeah, in a different way to somebody else, exactly. So again, it does actually help very much with creating characters when you're script writing. If you've done it for you, you then have to think, well, how does this character I've created actually do this too? That's what I think makes characters interesting, the little details
mm.
of how they would see the world based on who they are and what
mm.
they do.
Mm.
I found that myself very useful when I'm writing, because I do character-driven comedy drama. I tend to do character-driven comedy drama, and I love those little details of characters, of how they see the world. That's what really makes me excited, I suppose, about writing the characters.
Yeah.
How they're going to react is going to be based on
yeah.
what kind of a person they are, what they do for a living.
So for a new comic, really trust that your worldview will be unique as long as
yeah.
you can get honest and detailed enough about
yeah,
it.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. The more honest you are, the better.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not talking about... When I say honest, I don't mean sharing your life's greatest tragedies. That's something different. That's... You know,
tragedy.
That's yeah, that's... Yes, exactly. That is tragedy, or possibly something you need therapy for. I do always make it very clear when I introduce this first writing exercise that if you need therapy... You know, if you come across unresolved issues, you must get therapy, because I am not a therapist, I'm a stand-up comedy teacher. Those things don't work as comedy. Unresolved issues will never work as comedy. You have to sort of... If something's resolved, totally resolved, and you've got over that breakup, or, you know, whatever, then that actually might, once you can find it funny, that might make good humour. You know, laughing at the way in which you behaved... That might be funny.
Yeah.
You know, that might well work, but it's got to be resolved.
Well, let's just take a break for a minute.